بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله أما بعد أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Now I'm not going to accept the kind of weak response that you gave to my brother when he greeted you in this universal greeting of peace, a greeting that I know that all of us, if we don't understand that this is actually a supplication, this is a prayer. We are actually asking for the blessings of God to be upon those who are following right guidance. And so when I say to you, Assalamu alaikum, as your guest, you will say to me, Alhamdulillah, very good. Now, we are off to a very good start here. Brothers and sisters, I appreciate the organizers of this event, the MSA of UTM, for allowing me to come to be a part of the culminating program of a week-long of activities as they have been described to me. Because I think it's very important, and I think this week was called, Issues Affecting Humanity. And I think it's very important that young people like yourselves take the time and the opportunity to gather information, not just about who are the hottest rappers, who is 50 Cent, and who are some of these other rappers, but I think it's also important that you take the time and the opportunity to look at issues as they impact your life and your future from more than just the popular culture, more than just the hip-hop culture, more than just the culture of Muslim youth, more than just the culture of students, more than just the culture of those of you who are living in Toronto, more than just the culture of those who are living in Canada and those who are affected by the policies of the Canadian government. You to spend time thinking and reflecting and trying to actualize and simulate life in refugee camps and what it would be like, and not only what that life is like, but also how you as Canadians, in your active or passive support or non-support of certain activities, contribute to the existence of these refugee camps, I think that's very important. I think it's extremely important for you to take the time to reflect upon the impact of your actions and the actions of governments and companies and businesses, how they negatively impact upon the environment. It's very important. And equally important for the purpose of discussion this evening, is equally important for us to discuss this topic about shades, only shades of gray, as it relates to this one family that exists on the earth called the human family. And this human family is one that we know and we all accept, that this one family has come from a single family, that this human family only has various branches of the family. Like some of us in the United States in particular, particularly in the South, we're very known for having family reunions. And when we have these family reunions, we see Uncle Jed and Aunt Maud and Cousin Willie and Uncle Buck and Aunt Lou and all these people we haven't seen, and some of them we didn't even know were existent on the planet. And we have these family reunions and we come together and we hug and kiss. Well, I remember you were that small, and all these kind of attitudes. But there's only one human family, and the thing about trying to look at this family from a global perspective, if we view ourselves as part of a single race and a single family with just different branches, then maybe you and I can begin a process of thinking about how to treat fellow human beings, no matter what hue of their skin, no matter how their eyes are shaped, no matter what language they speak, no matter what foods they like to eat. If you, as I was talking to Abu Ala, that coming from an African-American background in the United States, we love, and I don't want to sound racist and stereotypical even about my own tribe that I come from, but we love chicken. You can't find many African-Americans, no matter what part of the country they come from, unless they're vegetarian, and they tell you, hey man, that was some good chicken, man. Can you have chicken on your menu? But some of us have to understand that even though I like or don't like chicken, that I am a part of family, a singular family, that if I care for my other family members, whether I know, like at the family reunion, they exist on the planet or not, it's very, very important that I embrace, that I accept, that I allow myself to love this person, whether I know them by name or not, that they are a part of me and I am a part of them, and we're sharing a space called Earth that we're not going to get any other Earth to replace the space with. And so I'd love to take a few minutes to talk about how we can educate ourselves and make it seem important to ourselves about creating an anti-racist environment. Talking about, just for a few moments, about what is it like to live, to see in your very eyes an anti-racial kind of environment and pluralistic kind of society being developed right in front of your very eyes. What does it mean to live in countries or be a part of some kind of social or geographical experience that people will tout one thing, that they will talk about equality and justice and freedom from all, and then turn right around and do things that are so opposite to what these words, these beautiful sounding words, are all about? Now, I want to try to frame this discussion within a certain context. And now, because I don't know a lot about a lot of things, I have to talk about a few things that I know a little bit about. And this evening, I'll talk about some things primarily from a context that I know about, because I've had to either live the experiences or have been a part of certain kinds of experience, whether it's physically experiencing things or learning about things through books and other means. And what I want to share with you as we talk about this thing called racism and how it can just infect a society, how it can so tear up an environment and destroy the individuals, not only the ones who are practicing racist feelings and attitudes, but also the people who are the victims of these attitudes. You know, coming from the southern part of the United States, coming from the state of North Carolina, I have a little experience, and being the age that I am, I have a little experience with racism. You see, growing up in North Carolina, at the time that I grew up, we had an apartheid system all across the southern states in the United States. I'm not going to try to give some euphemistic separate but equal or segregation. It was nothing short of apartheid. It was nothing short of apartheid for grown men and grown women and little children, little boys and little girls, to have to go to bathrooms that were marked colored, and they were just holes in the walls, and then others would go to bathrooms that were marked white, white only. It is nothing short of apartheid for grown men and women and little boys and girls to drink out of water fountains that were separate and distinctly unequal, to go to restrooms, to go to lunch counters, to do all of these things and suffer even physical violation of your body if you chose to violate those laws. And we find that in my own personal experience, which is an experience that can be multiplied by so many people in the United States, that in the lives of so many people, like I can, when my father would tell me about my great-grandfather George, he wasn't talking to me about a character out of a book or out of a movie. He was talking about my actual grandfather, who was a slave in the state of Virginia. That's pretty close. I mean, you don't need a timeline to put on the board to just think that your great-grandfather was a chattel slave in the state of Virginia in the United States. It doesn't take a real high understanding of social theory to my mother to tell me that how my part of the family got to North Carolina was because her father had the boldness to say something to a white American on the downtown streets in South Carolina, and that night the Ku Klux Klan, this racist group, came to his neighborhood to kill him. Not because he had hit or fought with someone, but just because he had tried to stand up and act with some dignity as a man to walk on the same sidewalk and not have to stand out in the street, that he had to flee his town and leave his home and do all of these things because people were trying to kill him, because he was an African American who had the boldness to just talk in a manly kind of way at a time when black men were supposed to speak to people in a manly kind of fashion. And so those are the only credentials that I offer up to be able to discuss this topic this evening. That is something that, in all honesty, that is a very passionate issue. Now let me move forward a little bit in discussion, because when we talk about racism and the expression of racism in society and all of these kinds of things, when we look historically and look on the timeline of the human family, there's no agreement amongst historians. You can take different historians and they can tell you at different points in human history when racist attitudes, when prejudice based on the color of one's skin, based on one's ethnicity, that every historian will probably give you a different timeline as to when that kind of racism appeared amongst the human family. But we can look throughout human history and we can see and we can read and we can understand and we can accept that there's almost always been some kind of prejudice going on in the human family, even if the people look like, talk like, and even like chicken, and everybody like the same kind of food, even in those environments. That there was something about us as human beings that somehow we had to find some measurement by which we can make ourselves feel superior to other people. So at various times we would say, well, I know we all look alike. I know we speak the same language, but you are from a certain caste. And I am superior eternally, no matter how many times I reappear on the face of the earth, no matter how incarnations I make, that I will always be like this, and you will always, until you reincarnate so many times, be beneath me. That in human society, no matter where people have lived, whether they are living in the land of the Pharaoh, whether they're living in whatever land, we find that there have been expressions of human prejudice against other human beings based on some predetermined system of value that's attached by human beings or by the color of one's skin. And so I can't offer up to you in some kind of academic way that can be verified, well, this is the point in human history where racism first appeared. Because my study has shown that there's been prejudice in so many societies for so long that it's hard to signal any one juncture in history in which people can say that I know that this is when this insidious attitude of, with other human beings actually began. But I will try to start at some point. And I will start at a point, and I'll submit, and I'll talk more about European history. I'll talk more about African history from a certain point. I'll talk more to try to bring this history to this part of the world. And bear with me for a moment. Some of you may be familiar with a page in human history, a page from the history of those people who call ourselves Muslims, that this page from this history in 711 on the Christian era, it tells us about a man by the name of Tariq ibn Ziyad in the Iberian Peninsula up into Spain, that he crossed with his armies, that he took his armies across this body of water, and that once he got on the other side, he ordered his troops to destroy the ship so they couldn't turn around and go back, that we're here. That we have left behind the homes and the culture and tradition, and now we're on another land and we have no intention to return. We know when we look at that history and follow that history that because of this historic event in 711, that this thing called Islam brought with it all of the goodness and all of the other things that would bring the thirst for knowledge, the inquiring minds to be unlocked, to bring a kind of enlightenment when we come into the 14th century. And all of this time, we see so much goodness coming across this peninsula with these Muslims coming into Spain. We see these people, or these Muslims, dominating that part of the world for hundreds of years, almost 800 years, that they became the dominant force on this peninsula. But just as they all brought all of the good things, they also brought some baggage with them. They brought some attitudes with them that may not have reflected the best that Islam had to offer to the world. And without getting too bogged down in this point in history, we find that those descendants of Tariq ibn Ziyad and others, that as the centuries creeped along, that we find that many of those who were now a part of the European continent were now taking people as slaves back into Africa, back into North Africa, back into West Africa, across the African continent and into the Middle East. That we find a white slave trade that many of the Muslims historically were involved in, who were taking people out of Europe and enslaving them in the Middle East and on the African continent. And people like Ivan van Sertima, a prolific writer and author of a book about the golden age of the Moors, that Ivan van Sertima has this idea that part of the racist attitude with Europeans really started once the Europeans started going off their continent in boats and sailing down the coast of Africa and sailing into North Africa, because there had been white slavery going on in Africa and the Middle East. So particularly the Spanish and the Portuguese, when they came down the coast of Africa, they came with a vengeance like never before. They acted like they hated the people. That they went into parts of Africa and they were just ruthless and just killing everything that they could find that could walk. That when they started sailing across the Atlantic Ocean, they still had this rage inside of them, and they came to a point where they then start savagely brutalizing the people who were in the Western Hemisphere, that in the United States we refer to them as Native Americans, I think you may refer to them as Aboriginals, that they were savage in the way that they dealt with these people. And then when you read history coming out of the 15th and 16th century, believe me, I'm going to get to the present. I just like a little history. This is Black History Month. Just bear with me for a minute. I'm going to get to the point. But they were savage in the way that they dealt. And when you read the writings of the 15th and 16th century, you see that King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella said that, I don't care. When they were slaving, they say, I don't care what you do with those Africans, just don't bring none of them Muslims, Africans, into the Western Hemisphere. We don't want to see them. We hate those Africans so much that we don't even want them as slaves because of our experience with them before our transatlantic slave trade started. So what they said was, no, we don't want them over here for no reason. If we catch you transporting them, we're going to sink the ship in the middle of the Atlantic. We may sink you with them because we don't want them Black African slaves, Muslim slaves, in the Western Hemisphere. And so Ivan van Sertima comes up with this idea that this event of this white slave trade that the descendants of Tariq ibn Ziyad and his descendants carried on, that this was one of the causes of the hatred that many of the Europeans, especially the Portuguese and the Spanish, had against people of color, and particularly against Muslims. Now, moving on a little bit in our time, we know, and it's not much argument about this, but we know that there are perhaps two states, and I'm not a historian, I just like history, so I could be wrong, and I stand corrected if I am, but I only know of two states that were created purely, solely, exclusively in semi-modern times on constitutions that clearly were prejudiced against other people. That was the country of South Africa and the country of the United States. That these were states in their formation that outlined a kind of caste system, an ironclad caste system that, according to the constitutions, defined what rights human beings would have. And guess what? In the United States, the Constitution said that people of African descent weren't even a full human being. That the U.S. Constitution said that people, these African people, were three-fifths of a human being. This is what was written into the United States Constitution. And so we find an attitude that in the very formative years of this land called the United States, we find an attitude of classism. We find an attitude of racism. We find an attitude that unless you had property, you were nothing. That unless you were white and male, you were nothing. That if you were white and female, you were in a higher category, but if you and had money, married to somebody with money, but if you had no money, you were in trouble. And these are the origins, these are the roots of the land that I reside in and grew up in, called the United States. Now let me go just a little further here. It's a wonderful experience for me to talk, and to particularly to talk to young people about the issues that we're talking about this evening, because this is Canada, for that reason and that reason alone. Because the land of Canada has represented a haven, a kind of safe haven for people in the United States who have been fleeing the persecution in the United States. That if you don't know about it, during the over 250 years of chattel slavery in the United States, there was a thing called the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad was not your caboose and your engine and rails or anything like this, but it was a pathway that came from the deep south, as far south as the most southern point in the United States, up into Canada, a very circuitous route in which people along the way would hide out runaway slaves until they could get to the so-called promised land of Canada. And so Canada has provided that haven consistently, continually, from persons fleeing some form of oppression in the United States. Even during the Vietnam War days, that a very dear brother to myself and to you, Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick, that Abdullah Hakim Quick also came to the land of Canada, fleeing the draft in the United States, because they were drafting young men like him and forcing them to go fight in Vietnam. And so Canada again opened its borders for persons in the United States who were fleeing what they felt their conscience was dictating to them was an unjust war and the drafting of people to go wage an unjust war against a so-called third world people. And so it's very encouraging when we look even today at the land of Canada, and we see that Canada has once again opened its borders. But this time the borders are being opened wide to those who are professing Islam. Because now in the United States, not solely based on the color of skin, but because of religion, there are hundreds and thousands of Muslims coming from the United States seeking political asylum, relocating themselves and their businesses all throughout Canada because of, again, the policies of the U.S. government. But this time it's not slave catchers, but it's the INS. It's the Immigration and Naturalization Service who are tracking down, like the slave catchers before them, tracking down Muslims from Muslim countries and tracking them down wherever they are, and not like the slave catchers of the past, putting them in back into slavery, but deporting them from the country, detaining them, and sending them, like we have a couple in the hometown where I come from, a group of Muslim law-abiding citizens who their tragedy is that they're from one of these countries on the list, and both the husband and the wife are politically active, and now they say that the husband must go to one country and the wife to another country, but they can't live together in the same country, that the infant children must go with the husband and not with the wife. And so now these modern day fugitives are looking at the possibility of coming to this land of Canada to seek some kind of asylum because of the prejudicial practices and policies of the government of the United States. Brothers and sisters, it's very important that even in a land like Canada, even those of you who are Muslim, those who understand the teachings of Islam that are completely anti-racial, those who understand that the system of society that is called for in the teachings of Islam, in the book that was revealed to the final prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and in his practice, that a society that is based not on one's color of their skin or their ethnicity, that one's status would not be based on one's wealth, but on one's closeness to submitting to the known guidelines of the Quran and the practice of Muhammad. that I want to caution you as I remind myself and caution myself that you, as who are Muslim Canadians, are not immune from the kind of infectious kind of attitude that just creeps up. It's like a snake in the darkness of the night that just creeps up into your bed and somehow just envelops you, and you wake up in the morning and you are one with this snake. Let me give you an example. I've had the opportunity to come to Toronto and to Canada a number of times, and oftentimes when I've come here, I've come and I don't comment on a lot of things that I see. I comment on a lot of things that I do see. And my attitude about the young Muslims here in Canada, and I'm not specifically just talking about Young Muslims as an organization or MSA as an organization, but what I see amongst the Muslim youth in this area is something that is very encouraging in the context of this discussion this evening for the future of Canada and the future of this continent. But I want to give a word of caution, and then I'll go on and conclude that you have to be careful, that all Canadians have to be careful. Who couldn't feel a sense of comfort when you look down at your southern neighbor and you see this cowboy with a questionable, and I'm not trying to talk about anybody because I know I'm not the brightest person in the world, so I wouldn't dare talk about the President of the United States and his mental capacity. I know he has a much higher IQ than he's pretending to have. I'm sure that this person who was Dr. Death when he was the governor of the state of Texas, the man that sat over more execution of inmates than any governor in the history of time, I'm sure that he's much more compassionate, a conservative, than his actions have shown us when he was the governor of Texas. So I know that as Canadians, when you look down and see what's going on in Canada, you've got to feel good about it. You've got to feel good. No matter what bad stuff I see going on, at least we don't have little George as the Prime Minister of Canada. And, you know, that's the attitude that I had for all so many years. I feel good now that we finally got rid of the, in the United States Senate, another high IQ senator by the name of Jesse Helms. It was an embarrassment. I was embarrassed to travel across America and say I was from North Carolina. They asked me, where are you from? North Carolina. Because we were sending for over 20 years an idiot, a complete idiot, an embarrassment to the Senate over 20 years sending from the state of North Carolina. So it's easy when you look at someone like little George, who talks like a B movie. He treats the world. He treats the world like he's a cowboy, like this is showdown at the OK Corral. All right, I give you 2 days. And after 2 days, you know, and he has the hand gestures and everything. So I know you, lady, and I feel good. Because now we don't just have Jesse Helms. We have George. But let me caution you about in this feel-good feeling. Because the times that I have come to Toronto in particular, and the times that I have spoken with people and tried to move around and see what's going on in this city alone, I see a growing phenomena like I saw a growing phenomena in the United States over the last 25 to 30 years. And that growing phenomena is a kind of a mini ghettoization. A certain part of the town. The ghettoization, not necessarily in the physical structures, because you have still in Canada streets that people like myself from the United States say, man, I could spread my tablecloth on these streets. They're so clean. Compared to the streets of the United States, I could eat off the busiest highway, the busiest street downtown because it's so clean. But what I find is that there's a kind of generalization that comes through that one-eyed potential monster called the television. That when you flip through your cable channels and you start stopping, and people start stopping on, I know y'all get BET here, right? You probably get MTV. You probably get some of these, I know you get these stations with so many of the videos that are so molding the minds and the thinking of the young people in the United States. That as certain populations enter into Toronto and into other parts of Canada, that they become imitators of a subculture in the United States, oftentimes the worst part of the subculture in the United States. And as certain populations grow, I began to hear more and more of the same kind of stereotypes about this population as I heard about those who were African American growing up in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and 90s in the United States. That those dudes are some criminal people. Man, every time I look up, I see some of them and they're standing around with their sagging pants, looking like they're just waiting to rob somebody. Did you hear about how this guy carjacked this person? Do you know, man, about these Asian gangs? You mean, Brother Kermit, you haven't heard about the Asian gangs? Y'all think you... Not y'all, that's a Southern. You know I'm talking Southern now. You all think that you have gangs in the States? You haven't seen anything until you see the actions of some of the Asian gangs. Man, do you see how these people keep their property? You see how they just throw stuff around and you go into the buildings where they live and it's not clean. They have no respect or love for their lawns. You go past their houses, they don't even cut the grass. Might have cars parked up in the grass, don't even park on the side of the street. I'm telling you, and sincerely, with a word of caution, that you and I have to be careful. Because every time we have this broad generalization and stereotype against an entire group of people, you are taking the first step in developing a prejudicial or even racist attitude against those people. That every time you look at someone with sagging pants and you stereotype that sagging pants to one group of Canadians or two group of Canadians, you have started the wicked road down a wicked path that gets very difficult to turn around and to come back the other way. And so again, you have a lot to be thankful for living in Canada. You don't have little George. You don't have a man who can't even read a teleprompter. They slow it down. You don't have a prime minister or a leader of your country. They had to quit telling you what he was really doing because most of his day he was on some kind of Nautilus machine, or he's watching 2 and 3 sports channels while he's doing his workout, while he's taking his naps in the evening, while people are bringing him briefing books about what's going on around the world, and he'll tell them, you read it. Tell me what it says. You don't have a leader of your nation who's like that. So you can feel good. You don't have an administration that's waging war all around the world, who's threatening anybody who says that we don't go along 100% with everything that you're saying. Who will say to the Muslims of the world, on one hand, come to my Eid party, on the other hand, I will use nuclear weapons against you if I think that you are doing anything to promote any kind of disharmony in the land of America. brothers and sisters, I want to close on a couple of notes. One, by saying, as I started, that I can only talk from the experience and context from which I come. And this, I want you to take the comments that I've made this evening. I want to offer up you one person from the history in modern day United States who I think embodies in his own personal development the potential of the human spirit to rest above any necessities could be God's will. And the poem that I want to leave you with, the man by the name of Al-Hajj Malik El-Faz, more commonly known as Malcolm X. And during this Black History Month, February the 21st, being the anniversary of martyrdom of Al-Hajj Malcolm X, I would be remiss if I didn't bring him in this discussion some kind of way. So bear while I say things. Malcolm X was a product of a racist environment, a environment that members from this race environment killed his father and two of his uncles. An institutionalized racist system that looked at a struggling family and carted them off like slaves being sent off to different plantations in different parts of a state. That he was product of an environment that had institutionalized a system that would keep permanently people of African descent on the underbelly of the social economic strata and ladder in the United States. That here was a person at once who had a brilliant mind as a young person who could think thoughts, who was very bright because of the racism in the educational system, crushed that spirit as a young person, and he just said, forget about this education, because it must not be for me. I'm running up into these kind of attitudes. I aspire to be a lawyer, but I'm told that I should be a carpenter, because being a lawyer is something unreal for a nigger to aspire to. Kind of system that just chewed up and devoured this individual, that by the grace that put up in a prison system for so many years, for 12 consecutive years of his life. But then the words of Malcolm himself said that God reached down into the mud and pulled him out of the mud and stood him up and cleaned and woke him up and cleaned him up. This man called Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, a Malcolm X, is one that Allah, in the last year of his life, put him on a course by having an experience just like people are gathering right today of making the pilgrimage to Mecca or going to Hajj, and all of the race teachings that he had become a part of his whole belief system, his whole lifestyle, that now he's a man who said that I will forever put down these racist ideas and racist teachings, because on Yusuf gathering called the Hajj, he saw for the first time with his own eyes how every part of the human family can come together with a common goal, that racist feelings would not be exhibited in this big gathering called the Hajj, that Allah, that God gave him a vision of what society can be. And then for the next 11 year months of his life on earth, he set upon a course to try to help undo those wrong teachings that he had imparted to people, those attempts that he had made to link racist teachings coming from white folks with racist teachings coming from black folks, saying that black folk and white folk should never ever come together, should always live separate and apart. But Allah allowed this man, who had had an experience that could have crushed him, that were it not for Allah's will, that you and I, that I thank God every day that I had not been burdened with something so intense, because I'm a weak man. I couldn't have withstood what this man withstood and still come out shining like a prince. But here is the potential for every person that we look at today, and we laugh at that person and we say, look at that ignorant in the the phraseology of the Muslims as we like to throw around with so much disdain. Look at that kafir. Look at that disbeliever. Look at that person standing on the corner getting drunk. Look at that person using drugs. Look at that person standing there sagging. But all I need to do and all you need to do is look at the life of Malcolm X, and you can see that yes, this is that the human spirit, if it is submissive to the will of God, is capable of rising above its circumstance and experiences and becoming this flower that the world can look bloom in all of its beauty. And so I want to remind myself, as I remind you, that if you are Muslim, and if you believe that this thing called Islam is the truth, then what you will do and what I will do will be to organize, to struggle, to come together to make our environments truly anti-racist environments. There are just a few quick steps. That first of all, when someone, there's a saying attributed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him, that when a person is saying something bad to you, saying something bad about another person, then you need to stop them from talking to you. You don't have to be the one who's saying something bad about Brother Khaled. That chicken eating Bigfoot dude, you may not be the one that is saying it. But the last prophet of Allah has said, it damages your soul to listen to someone talking to you negatively about another human being. So what you and I can do to help stay off of this path of racism and to help try to create an anti-racist society and maintain that society is don't be the one saying it, but don't be the one receiving the negativity about another people, particularly if it's someone that is from another group other than yourself. Because it's so easy, like a fly sticking to fly paper, for that to stick somewhere in your mind, to stick somewhere in your heart. And the next time you see that joke that was made about another person, particularly a person from another group, now that becomes your attitude. Well, you know, Suhail said that. Maybe he was telling the truth. But Suhail may have been out of taste, saying a bad joke. But now you've adopted this negative stereotype. That you and I need to get familiar with those outside of our comfort areas, our comfort zones. That it's easy to fraternize, to socialize with people who eat what you eat, who wear what you wear, who speak perhaps the same second or third language that you speak, who have common cultural practices and backgrounds. But you and I have to stretch ourselves to become familiar with those outside of those comfort zones and those limits. That you and I, and on this I will close, need to educate ourselves about other people and about history. One thing that Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz has said, and many other persons have said, this is not an original quote from Malcolm X, but one idea that has gained currency over the years, that if you don't learn from the history, then you're going to be forced to repeat it. That if you don't learn your lessons well from the things of the past, then you are going to be forced to have to relive that history. And so I submit to you who are sitting here tonight that you and I need to learn from our history. We don't need to have to repeat the negative consequences of not learning from the past. We don't need to have to repeat that. That we can learn from our history. That we can learn from the history of resistance against oppression and racism in the North American context. Look for a moment. Take the time to learn and read and study about the history of the so-called civil rights and black power movement in the United States. It will amaze you, it will startle you, if you take the time to read beyond the stereotypes. If you take the time to, if you don't want to read it, I suggest that you watch a video, I don't think it's on DVD yet, a video series called Eyes on the Prize. This was put by Public Broadcasting System in the United States, in PBS, on public television stations in PBS. You can purchase the video. I think, I don't know if Sound Vision has it, but some of the Muslim places have this series of videos, and it chronicles the history of struggle that people like Manning Marable, an outstanding activist and writer in the United States, call this period the Second Reconstruction. The Second Reconstruction, because he says the First Reconstruction after the Civil War that lasted about maybe less than 12 years, that this was a period where everybody in America had a non-racist, multicultural vision of America. That there were black senators, black governors, black members of the House of Representatives. That there were all kinds of rules that were allowing people to see a pluralistic society in the United States. And then the struggle against oppression from about 1945 or 46 up into the early 80s being considered a second reconstruction in the United States. So I encourage you to educate yourself about the history of the Aboriginals here in Canada, even here in Toronto. I don't want to embarrass anyone or embarrass myself, but this is the University of Toronto at, what does the M stand for? How many of you know about this tribe, this nation, the Mississauga Nation? Okay. If you don't know anything about them and you just think that this is just an area, a suburb, this is a burb around Toronto or what you think it is, you need to learn about what that M represents. Abuala told me an interesting story. We were coming and he was showing me this real wealthy area and he was telling me the story about how the property came from what it was at one time to what it is now. It's a very interesting story. Learn your history. This is the country that you have either adopted or that you were born into. This is home. I would dare say very few of you will return to live in the home of your mothers and your fathers and your grandparents. This is home. So treat it like I treat my home. There's nowhere I can be deported to. I can only be put into a prison. My bloodline goes too far back. They couldn't figure out, and I can't figure out, where you would deport me to. So that is home. Canada and this country, for most of you, is your home. Treat it like your home. Learn the history of your home. Learn the lessons that can be gotten from that history from the people of this land. Learn the lessons of the anti-racist, learn the positive lessons of struggle of the people from this land. I want to end on this note. I want to ask for the forgiveness from Allah and for your forgiveness and indulgence if I've said anything against the book of Allah, the Quran, are the sunnah, are traditions of the last prophet of Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, peace be upon him, and that only the mistakes have been mine. That's an honor. JazakAllah, thank you very much for your insightful words. We'd like to now open the floor to questions. So if you have any questions, you can write them down, or you can simply put up your hand, and I'll point to you, and then just verbalize your question, inshallah. Essentially, this question says, can you give us any tips to know if we're becoming prejudiced in our views, or just approaching that type of prejudice?
Actually, very quickly, I just wanted to repeat what I said earlier, that when you find yourself finding racist and stereotypical jokes funny about other people, you're on the way. You're on the way. It's always easy to laugh at the expense of someone else. In the United States, the Polish people have become the butt of every dumb person joke until George Bush, this little George. Now he's the butt of all of the dumb person jokes. But before that, the Polish people, as a people, were stereotyped, oh, that's some dumb Polak. This was the attitude of people in the United States against people of Polish descent. Every time I laugh at those kinds of jokes, then I'm internalizing racist attitudes about another people. So I think the start is cutting it off, being sensitive and conscious of the fact that I'm laughing at some other people's expense, that generalizations are being made, and I'm buying into it. And I think the other thing is that when we find ourselves, like we have Eid al-Adha coming up, and if you find yourself on this glorious celebration of the Eid, only conversing with and talking to and hugging on brothers who look like you, who talk like you, who all of these other things, people that you know, then for some reason, unless you just extraordinarily shy, you are cutting yourself off from gaining familiarity with someone else outside of your group, outside of your branch of the family. And so I encourage us to start reaching out, stretching out outside the branches of our family, that when we're having social events, to reach beyond our branch of the family and bring somebody else in. Bring cousin Ned that you didn't know who existed until yesterday. Bring cousin Ned on in there, right? Bring Abdullah that you don't know anything about. Bring Abdullah in and learn from Abdullah. But I think for all of us, it starts at laughing at other people's expense, especially when there's stereotypical kinds of jokes or attitudes that are being expressed. Another question. Okay, you mentioned this ghettoization. How do we avoid and stay away from this? It's a very it's very difficult sometimes. It may be a little easier here in Canada, but I doubt if it's so much easier. But this whole ghettoization process begins when we embrace and adopt ideas that are either foreign or even against, more so against, the culture of Islam. By culture of Islam, I'm only talking about those things that fall into these broad categories of halal and haram. Those things that are halal from any culture or part of Islamic culture. For an example, I don't have to wear a certain dress to follow the dictates of Islamic culture. If I don't have on biker pants, which I don't, I have on loose baggy pants, if my private areas are covered, if I'm not wearing see-through garments, then this is part in my shallow understanding of Islam, then this meets the standard of an Islamic cultural dress, because it is not violating any particular Islamic cultural standard for the dress. But when you and I begin to adopt a style of dress, when we begin to talk in a certain kind of way, I'm not talking about like me saying y'all, because people down south more comfortable saying y'all than you all and these kinds of things. But when we start talking in a certain way, using certain expressions, and I don't want to use that expressions that have come off of these many of these rap videos and these kinds of things in referencing females or in females referencing males and these kinds of things, when that becomes a part of how we interact with one another or with people that we don't know, then we are starting and are part of this ghettoization of our practice of Islam. That we are bringing into Islamic culture those things that are lawful, things that are unlawful, and adopting and embracing them as our own. So there are certain styles, that the styles, just as the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because there was such an addiction to drinking wine, that when Allah made it forbidden to drink wine in any quantity, the surah tells us that immediately upon hearing the ayah, criers were going through the streets telling the people, wine is haram, haram, khamr is haram. And that the people start breaking these big vats of wine that they use to store wine. Big things like this. These weren't 40 ounces, right? These weren't quarts. These weren't fifths of liquor. These were big pots of wine like this. And the sirah, the history tells us that wine flowed through the streets of Medina. And after that, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam told his sahaba, his companions, those containers are haram. Don't even use the containers, because they remind you of what you used to put in them. You may get a psychological high from your water, that you drink so much wine out this thing that you may tilt that thing over, get you some water, and you start thinking about how blasted you used to get drinking out of that same container. So the Prophet ﷺ said, you can't use it. Get it out. And then later on, it doesn't have the same association, so it's okay. Drink from it. But it was the association at the time. So what I'm suggesting is that as young people, as old people, we have to be careful that we don't embrace aspects of a culture that are so identified with something that is haram that you are encouraging, you're promoting this wrong. For example, some of these, I saw a young Muslim in North Carolina not too long ago, and the kid had this necklace on. And I didn't pay much attention to it at first. You know, I saw it wasn't gold, as a young man. It was a silver necklace, and I thought maybe he had some kind of medallion, some calligraphy or something. I didn't pay any attention to it. And after a while, it popped out on the front of his shirt. It was in silver, but it was like a marijuana leaf, the shape of a marijuana leaf. Now, I'm an old guy, you know, and I don't know a lot of things, but I know a marijuana leaf. A semblance of a marijuana leaf when I see it. So I thought, you know, what do you have on around your neck? Because I thought maybe he got it from somewhere, didn't know what it was. He said, oh, Imam, this is just a leaf. I said, what kind of leaf? Well, you know what it is. I said, why do you have it on your neck? Well, I don't smoke it or anything, but, you know, everybody in school, they wear it. But this is haram. Why not put a 40 ounce around a can around your neck? If you don't think there's anything wrong with the marijuana leaf, hang a 10, a 40 around your neck, and everybody will love you. You'll start a new trend. People will be walking around with 40 ounces around their neck. So whenever we bring things like this into our practice, we are starting this process of ghettoization of the Islam that we're practicing today.
Okay. How does a person remain proud of their heritage yet not fall into the cycle of racism? Very good question. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was reported to have answered, having a discussion about asabiyya, about nationalism. And he was talking about how asabiyya, this nationalism, is a bad thing. And the narration goes on to say that as those who were hearing him listened, one of the brothers said, "Well, you know, I love my people, Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I mean, does that mean because I love my people that this is the kind of negative nationalism that you're talking about?" He said, "No, that's not what I'm talking about. And it's okay to love your people. You're supposed to love your people. Hate yourself, you're in bad trouble. Hate because, I mean, I've heard some young brothers from the subcontinent talk about Pakistanis like they were racist white folk talking about a black person in Mississippi. And they were Pakistani. And it sort of freaked me out. It's like, well, I mean, what's happening here, man? I'm missing something here, man. Help me understand this. Now, I know that there's some stuff that black folk do that I'm definitely not proud of. But I'm not going to go around here and start hating black people. I ain't going to join the Klan. Because you out there selling dope on the corner, it ain't gonna make me start hating my own tribe because you're doing this thing." So the Prophet went on to say that no, asabiyya, this negative kind of nationalism, is loving your people and upholding them when they're doing wrong. Helping your brother when they're doing wrong. So there was an expression, kind of a mantra, at the time of the Prophet in Mecca, in Medina, to help your brother whether he's right or wrong. The Prophet said, turn it around. He said, yeah, help your brother whether he's right or wrong. One of the companions said, well, hey, I can understand supporting and helping when he's right, but how are you going to help him when he's wrong? He said, well, stop him from doing wrong. Okay? Don't uphold the wrong, but by the same token, don't hate the person who's doing wrong. Because the same young Muslim who's chasing girls and showing no regard for the restrictions about relationship with men and women until they're married, the same one who's getting high, the same one who's drinking, the same one who's doing all of these things today, Allah can change that person's heart and bring them back to a kind of practice that you and I will never be able to achieve. I've seen it happen. Within my long lifetime, to many of you, but within my lifetime, I've seen it happen with so many people. So don't uphold your brother or sister when they're doing what's wrong. Stop them. But don't hate them when they're doing what's wrong either. It's okay to love, but not loving folks and supporting them when they're doing what's wrong. Now, it's a very, very good question that you asked me. It's a very, very good question. Because old people like myself, who experienced certain things in the 60s and the 70s, are patiently sitting back waiting for this cycle of consciousness to come back around. Because when you read the history of the states and the history of this country, you see that consciousness has gone in cycles. And some of us believe that it's getting close to coming back around into a consciousness cycle. And it's so interesting that the point that you make to me, because I'm one of those who believe that at this point, a lot of the popular culture with young folk, particularly a lot of hip hop culture, is now the movement that existed during the 60s and 70s. The movement is these different knowledge of and imitation of these different groups and, you know, thugging out and all of this stuff, that this has become the norm. And those who step outside of the norm are like, I don't know if you're familiar with this expression, this is something that the young kids that I work with, I pick up all these expressions. Now they are the L7s of the day. Anybody know what L7 is?
So y'all don't know what's happening, man. Y'all don't know. You don't know. Now, L7, it says, is a square. When you got a 7, you got L, you put them together, and somehow it comes up with a square. So L7 is a square. So anybody who's not dressing in a certain way, like we had a young kid at school, we don't allow our boys or the girls to sag. That's a real big thing in the program that I'm director of. And so some of the kids step in the door, and they have their pants all up on their waist, and they have their belts and everything. And you can just look at the guys. They stand there looking at him, shaking their head. Man, look at this L7 joker, man. Where is this guy coming from? So in response to your question, I do believe that until a kind of mass consciousness begins to develop, we're going to have to take it block by block. We're going to have to take it person by person, row by row. Because what happened in the 60s and the 70s, the media, the mainstream media, treated a lot of these things, these events, these consciousness events, as media items. And they sensationalize a lot of things. So they popularize a lot of leaders and popularize a lot of expressions and books and all these things. And then they start saying, now, wait a minute, this is working against us a little bit. We might be selling a few more magazines writing about this dude, but we are exposing his or her ideas to all of these other people that if we had just isolated them and ignored them, then nobody would even know what they're talking about except for the people in the room where the person, where he or she is speaking. So what has happened of late in recent years is that the media does not give a voice, a mass voice, to people who are calling young people and old people to a certain consciousness and to a certain behavior. And I submit, and I'm not projecting Louis Farrakhan as some embodiment of Islamic practice or anything, orthodoxy, anything like that. But if you notice that after the Million Man March, the media starts scratching their head and figuring out, now, wait a minute, man. We helped him get 1 million people in Washington, D.C. We helped him get 1 million men in Washington, D.C. because we cracked on him so much. We demonized him so much in the media that almost everybody who had a television knew what was going on. So what we're doing, we're just basically, virtually ignore him. Make him have to get person by person, one by one, to try to mobilize that number of men or women again. And so I think that, and Allah knows best, but right now, we are not in a position to provide the big media splash that we had during the 60s and the 70s. We can't do it. So it's going to be a more quiet, maybe an even more steady, even more well thought out movement that will come about, because we're not as much into the headlines now as into doing the quiet, methodical work. Not that, like, you know, I'm sitting in the basement trying to, you know, put together some bomb or something like that. That's not what I'm talking about. But we're just more methodically, systematically making steps because, like, I'll give you one example. We're going to the next thing. One example. In 1967, Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, and people attribute the term black power to, at that time, Stokely Carmichael. They attribute this term to him. He said, in his own words, he was just riding in a car in Mississippi. They were coming from a rally or something, and there were a group of African Americans standing there, and he rode by, and it happened to be some reporters there, and he hollered out to one, the black power! With no forethought, with no plan or anything. It was just a spontaneous reaction. When the car stopped, the media running up to him, Stokely, tell us about this black power. What is exactly black power? And he said that from that moment, he had to start trying to formulate some kind of explanation as to what black power was all about. But he was just hollering out the window, black power! But the media jumped all over. So now, if we run out the building, Allahu Akbar, right? Now, the media may jump on that because they say, I'm in here inciting some kind of jihad, or this is some war whoop that I'm doing up in here or something. But the point that I make is that the media has learned from the past. Oftentimes, we are much slower to learn those lessons and make adjustments. So the movement today, and even amongst the youth, should take a different kind of approach, not so much in its substance, but in its approach, because things have changed so radically today. Okay, during your speech, you mentioned that we ought to be informed about other countries and races. At times, this can be difficult, as information is constantly being screened to what the media wishes to portray. How can we attempt to absorb only what is correct about a culture or race? Please expand on this topic. This is a very good question. I think every day we struggle mightily to try to get correct information. You all may laugh at me if I say this, because I don't know how you feel about this channel. But I found myself recently, rather than watching the U.S. government's official channel, which I believe, CNN, I find myself watching CBC International. Now, I don't know if they broadcast it locally, but the Canadian broadcast, I found in watching cable TV, is more, gives me information and a slant about world opinion, about U.S. policy and government, that we can't get in watching the channels in the United States. But then we also have to reach out, and we stretch out to shortwave radio. Also have to stretch out and get to the internet. And there are some other very good sites that I know Abu Allah in particular could come up with a list before we leave out of here to give everybody different websites that we could go to get accurate information on prejudiced information about events that are taking place in the world. Because sometimes, and I've had the opportunity in being outside of the United States, when certain events have captured the world's attention, and then when I've gone to another country or countries and hear the reports and look at the news or read the English language papers about the same thing that's been hammered on us in the United States, you think that they're talking about two totally different events. You got the U.S. version, and then you have the rest of the world's version. So I think that we need to take advantage of media and information outlets other than just the Toronto Star and, is it the Star here? Toronto Star and other publications like that. Reach, stretch a little bit, and you don't have to go too far out on the limb to get the fruit. And I think, especially with the advantage of the internet, that we'll be able to get information. But also read books. The internet and the computer age is here, but there's a lot of stuff that you just can't beat good old fashioned cover to cover reading of a book. Okay? Read books. Get good information out of books. Okay, how would you comment on the news that the state is raising the alert status, my man Ashcroft mentioned, of the hard season, the highest degree? You know, the entire Little George administration, in the eyes, when the history is written, you find that Little George and his daddy have probably assembled the greatest group of criminals and gangsters that have been in a U.S. administration since George chopped down the cherry tree as the first, you know, myth about the president, George Washington, the first president of the United States. These people are, and I'm saying this, they are a scary lot of characters. Before Islam, I've attempted to be politically active in a number of different areas. And I have stood in Lafayette Park across from the White House on platforms and have criticized administrations from the time I was in D.C. of Nixon and Ford and Jimmy Carter, those three administrations while I was in D.C. And Nixon, up until this point, was the scariest in how he used the intelligence and the military and everything else. He was a scary guy. But no one is as scary as Little George and his gang of gangsters, like Ashcroft and this guy Rumsfeld. They're a scary group of people. It's almost like when you read the stories about the Crusades, right? Some of you young folks who can write satire, I mean, you would do us a good service, because I just don't have time, and I'm not that good a writer. I don't have time to try to pen something myself. But some of y'all who are good writers, who can write good satire, you need to write characters and give stories about people like Rumsfeld and Ashcroft and all these people, learn about what they're doing, and write children's stories. And then if you want your children, especially children in the United States, to be good, you don't read them as bedside tales, you read them as horror stories. There'd be something to scare your child. If you don't be good, Ashcroft is going to get you. He's going to put a microphone and a camera inside Teddy Bear. And Teddy Bear's going to look, because these people are scary, y'all. They are scary. And so that's the climate in which we have to operate. This is what we have to do right now.